I walked a few yards that way and was in deep shadow near a retaining wall when the Pathfinder came closer, headlights off. I could see the silhouette of Cassidy sitting sideways, facing the driver, who was just a dark shape until the Pathfinder crossed beneath a street lamp. For a second, his face was clearly visible through the windshield. Recognition stopped me cold. I was confused. What was Annie Cassidy doing with Alden Lindell? Chapter 69. Gretchen Lindell's father used to tell her that the brain could be the strongest part of the body or the most fragile. "It's your choice, Gretch," he'd said not long before she'd been taken captive in the twisted world of sickos. Lying on her filthy mattress in her plywood cell, holding her left leg so it wouldn't be irritated any further by the manacle around her ankle, the 17-year-old was doing everything she could to keep her mind strong. "I'm going to get out of here," Gretchen kept telling herself. "I just have to survive long enough to get the chance. I'm going to be like Dad. Nothing they've done hurts me in any way. It makes me stronger. This only makes me stronger." But it had been several days since they'd come for her. Hour upon hour of silence created all sorts of dark voices in her mind. Doubt crept up on Gretchen and whispered that she'd die there in the box. Fear wormed its way into her stomach and said they'd take her again before that happened. Self-pity wrapped her head and heart, told her she was defeated. But time and time again, whenever Gretchen realized the voices of despair were taking control of her thoughts, she'd think of her father and everything he'd endured, and she'd take heart. "I will survive. They can't hurt me. This will only make me..." The deadbolts turned. She closed her eyes, not knowing if this was a meal or another of their twisted games. If it was a game, she was done crying. She was done being scared. They seemed to feed on her fright, and as the door swung open, she vowed to give them none. The big one in black came in carrying a semi-automatic AR rifle. Her father had one just like it. "It's time, Gretchen," he said from behind the paintball mask. "We're all but done here. Clean-up time now." Gretchen said nothing, just stared through him as if he didn't matter anymore, as if nothing mattered anymore. "Be like Dad," she thought as she went to work on her ankle manacle. "For God's sake, be like Dad." Chapter 70. Had that been Gretchen Lindell's father driving the Pathfinder? I kept trying to convince myself I was wrong, but each time I closed my eyes, I saw Alden Lindell clearly. But why? And how? When Annie Cassidy called to set up the appointment, she'd said that Father Fior had referred her, hadn't she? Well, now that I thought about it, she hadn't actually used his name. She'd said she'd gotten my number from a mutual friend, a priest with challenging problems. And Lindell? He'd contacted me directly. No reference that I remembered. What were the odds of two people who knew each other coming to my office and never mentioning it to me? I thought about Gretchen Lindell's mother, Eliza, and how distraught she'd been in the days after her daughter's kidnapping. Was Annie Cassidy the reason she and her husband separated? Had she used fake names for her lovers? Was Alden Lindell actually Carlos? I went inside, told my grandmother I was going out, and got the car keys. By the time I drove into a residential neighborhood west of the Cabin John Parkway, it was pitch dark and the rain had stopped. I found the address I was looking for and parked the car across the street from a brick-faced colonial with a big flower bed gone dormant, a crushed gravel driveway, and a bronze Volvo station wagon. Lights gleamed in the narrow windows that flanked the front door. I climbed out, smelled wet leaves, and started toward the house, wondering about the reception I'd get, a lone man at night unannounced. My cell phone buzzed. I ignored it, climbed the stoop, and rang the bell. A dog started barking. A small Jack Russell Terrier was soon bouncing and barking an alarm on the other side of the lower right window. Tinker, a woman said. Get back, girl. The dog kept barking and then yelped in protest when the woman grabbed her and held her in her arms. She peered blearily out the window at me. Despite the exhaustion and despair that seemed to hang off her like rags, I recognized her. Mrs. Lindell? I said. Eliza? The terrier in her arms showed her teeth. She said, If you're a reporter, please go away. You're not helping the situation. No one's helping the situation here. I'm not a reporter, I said. My name is Alex Cross. My son, Ali, goes to school at Latin with Gretchen. Eliza studied me a long moment before opening the door. The dog growled like a little demon. Hush now, Eliza said, and the dog stilled but kept a close eye on me. The missing girl's mother was in her mid-30s but looked older in baggy sweatpants, Birkenstock sandals, and a George Mason University tee. Her hair was in disarray and graying at the roots. Her eyes were bloodshot, rheumy. Alex Cross, she said, you're that cop on trial for murder. Innocent as charged. I read you've killed 11 people. In the course of duty I have, that's true. I also read you've found kidnapped girls before. That's also true, including my niece, who today is part of my defense team. Life can go on after an abduction, Mrs. Lindell. That's why you're here? In part. Can I come in? She hesitated, then stuck her face in her dog's face. You be good now, Tinker. Here? Tinker licked her cheek. Eliza set the dog down. The Jack Russell eyed me when Eliza stood aside and I entered. I smelled gin and cigarettes as I walked past her into a center hall lined with hooks where pictures had once hung. Is there somewhere we can sit and talk? I asked. The kitchen, straight ahead. She followed me down the hallway through an open doorway into a dingy white kitchen where dirty dishes were piled high in the sink. Newspapers and unopened mail covered the table, and prescription bottles took up two entire shelves of a bookcase. I caught a whiff of something antiseptic and thought I heard muffled voices. How are you holding up? I said. Eliza pushed back a strand of hair. How does it look like I'm holding up? I can't help asking. The picture's in the hall. She stared at me. Her lower lip quivered. I couldn't take looking at Gretchen anymore. She was ripping me up every time I walked through there. The stress must feel unbearable. You don't know the half of it. Your husband? She stiffened. Alden? Alden's Alden. A trooper. Never gives up hope. Never says die. I'm a clinical psychologist by training. I don't know if he's told you, but he's been seeing me for therapy. She crossed her arms and studied me skeptically. No, he didn't say anything. Two sessions. Really? You'd think he would have told me. Why don't we go ask him why he didn't? My pulse quickened. He's here? I just saw him heading toward Capitol Hill. He looked like he was out for a night on the town with another woman. Another woman? She laughed sarcastically. I bet he smelled of cheap perfume, didn't he?
I didn't get close enough.
Well, you can now, she said, gesturing at a door at the far end of the kitchen. Alden's right through there, watching Game of Thrones. Let's go talk to him. Get things out in the open. Let's do that, I said. I crossed the kitchen and went through the door. Chapter 71. A wave of antiseptic smells hit me as I stepped down into a space set up as a hospital room. To my right, shelves bulged with medical equipment, supplies, and clean linens. To my immediate left, there was a tall green oxygen tank with a hose that ran over to a hospital bed with its back raised. Beyond the tank, an array of electronic monitors cheeped and beeped over the sounds coming from a speaker system linked to the big screen mounted on the opposite wall. According to a tag in the lower right corner of the screen, Season 3, Episode 4 of Game of Thrones was showing. I took a few more steps into the room and saw a man in the bed. He reminded me of the physicist Stephen Hawking, gaunt, bent, and curled up by disease. Breathing oxygen through a nasal cannula, he lay on his right side, wore glasses, and watched the screen intently, seeming to have no idea we were there. "That's not the Alden Lindell who came to see me," I said.
"I didn't think so," Eliza said.
"I don't know why I didn't check."
"Why would you?
We're private about Al's challenges because that's the way he wants it. How could you have known he has end-stage ALS?"
"I suppose," I said,
and I felt baffled, until I realized that the man who'd posed as Alden Lindell brought me the flash drives that showed the mock executions of Gretchen Lindell. No one had sent those drives to him. He was part of killing blonde chicks for fun, and so was the love junkie. Tinker darted by us and jumped up on the bed, wagging her tail.
"Eliza,"
an electronic voice said. She smiled at me before going to his side.
"Right here, Al."
"Next?"
"You're not even through that one yet, and the next is in the queue," she said with a glance at me. "He loves this show."
"Smart dwarf," he said.
"Boobs."
"Yes, Tyrion and lots of boobs," she said matter-of-factly.
"I'd like you to meet someone, Al. He's trying to find Gretchen for us."
I came over to her husband's bedside. Laboring for breath, the real father of the missing blonde girl rolled his eyes up to me. "I'm Alex Cross, sir," I said. He had a digital tablet next to him on the mattress. He rolled his eyes down and blinked 11 or 12 times, maybe more.
"I know you," the tablet said a few seconds later.
"Wow," I said. "How does that work?" Eliza said, "The tablet's built with 3 camera lenses which triangulate to pick up where he's looking on the screen, which shows a keyboard layout. He looks at a letter on the keyboard and blinks. When he blinks twice, he's done with the word. Blinks 3 times, and the voice comes on."
"That's amazing."
"I think so." The tablet voice said,
"B. Lowe's, you ask me."
Lindell was peering at me again, and I nodded in sympathy. He looked at the tablet. A few seconds later, the voice said,
"Where's my Gretch?"
Thinking about the fake Alden Lindell and Annie Cassidy coming to my office, I said, "She could be closer than we think, within driving distance." The missing girl's father looked down at the tablet. His synthesized voice said,
"Can't even cry for her."
Eliza's hand shot to her lips. "It's true. His tear ducts are shutting down. We have to put drops in every 2 hours." Her husband rolled his attention to the tablet for the longest time yet before the voice said,
"My time is near, Cross. My last wish is to see my Gretch again, one last time."
He peered up at me. Even though his body and face were virtually frozen, I could see the desperate hope in his eyes.
"I'll do my best, Al," I said. "Just hang on."
I gave Eliza Lindell my cell phone number, said goodbye to her and her husband, and left the house feeling humbled. The day before, with the weight of the evidence in my murder trial so stacked against me, I'd been thinking that life was treating me pretty damn unfairly. But here, the real Alden Lindell's life was being squeezed from him by a disease that was killing him one paralyzed muscle at a time. And there was his courageous wife, caring for him and worried sick about their missing daughter. All in all, I had nothing to bitch about. I got in the car thanking God and the universe for the blessings in my life. My wife, my family, my home, my health, my friends, my cell phone rang. It was Anita Marley. "Judge Larch had a transient ischemic attack," she said. "No stroke."
"Hey, that's good news."
"It is," she said. "I like Judge Larch a lot. Her clerk's saying we're back in session the day after tomorrow."
"Even better."
"You still sticking with your story about the guns?"
"Yes. I'm telling you I saw them."
"My analysts agree with the FBI. There's no evidence of doctoring. But we'll try to raise some reasonable doubt based on the fact that the phones were supposedly in the factory for months." I wasn't convinced it would do any good. Later, as I was turning onto Fifth, my phone rang again. Samson said,
"Are you busy tomorrow?"
"No trial until Wednesday."
Tell Bree I'm taking you fishing in Pennsylvania to get your mind off things. I'll pick you up at 5. Chapter 72. In the chill gray light of an autumn dawn, I watched fog swirling around the trunks and through the branches of leafless oak trees. Clusters of acorns still clung to some, but many more littered the forest floor. It was quiet, but for the distant sound of a creak and the irregular patter of oak mast falling. "Alex," Samson said behind me. "I got it to work, finally." I turned to find him looking at an iPad on the hood of his Grand Cherokee. Still clutching my second big cup of fast food coffee, I walked over and looked at the iPad, which had a satellite connection. Samson had the Google Earth app launched. It gave us a bird's-eye view of a rural area 40 miles northwest of Williamsport, Pennsylvania, where several creeks met and formed a trout stream roughly 3 miles from where we were standing. The stream ran by a 50-acre property adjoining an unpaved country road. A long two-track driveway wound from the road past meadows to a line of mature pines that shielded a large hollow between two ridges. A modest ranch house sat in a clearing in the bottom of the hollow. There was a barn larger than the house and 5 other sheds and smaller structures. A substantial garden flanked the back of the barn. Beside the garden stood a big satellite dish. I tapped on the dish. "That's what they're keying on?" Samson nodded. "Big bandwidth coming and going. Lots of electricity being used on the property. And many of the recent uploads to Killing Blonde Chicks have evidently come through that satellite dish. We've got the IP address." "Seems strange," I said. "When Crazy Cat Rollins looked at that website, he couldn't tell where most of the videos of blondes were coming from because they used onion routers. And our guys were able to track them?"
"Maybe the guys making them got lazy," Samson said. "It happens."
"The woods around here do look like the woods in the videos of Gretchen Lindell and Delilah Franks," I said. "The blondes running in the trees."
"I remember," Samson said. "And the lesbian girls disappeared less than 60 miles east of here. They could all be in that house or in any of those outbuildings.
Wish you'd gotten the search warrant."
"Not enough evidence yet," the judge said, "which is why you're here and Fox isn't. Like I said, we're going fishing."
We got back in the car. It felt good to be riding shotgun with Samson again. My world seemed even better than it had leaving the Lindells the evening before. I switched the iPad app to Google Maps and used it to navigate the labyrinth of dirt roads around the property. Somewhere on it, there was a computer belonging to a 27-year-old named Carter Flint. In the satellite image, there were 6 or 7 vehicles in Flint's yard. But driving past that line of pines into the hollow, we spotted only 2. A faded red Ford Ranger pickup and an old Toyota Corolla that looked in need of springs, both with their noses toward an embankment below the ranch house. Samson parked sideways behind them, blocking anyone trying for a quick exit. We got out. The fog was lifting from the ridges above the hollow. A dog barked in the distance beyond the pole barn. Closer, I heard the blatting of a sheep and the squeal of a pig or two. We went up a crumbling brick walkway and knocked on the front door. No answer. No sounds inside. Samson knocked again, and I thought I caught a flutter of movement in a window to my right. But again, there was no answer. "Let's take a look around," I said. "Maybe he's in the barn." As we crossed the yard and got closer to the barn, the animal sounds got louder, more frantic. The dog barking, the sheep blatting, and the pig squealing. I knocked at a side door, then tried the knob. It turned. I pushed the door open. Bells hanging on the inner knob jangled. The pig started squealing in an even higher pitch. The sheep blatted in terror. So did the dog. It sounded desperate, crying and yelping. We stepped inside and took in the cavernous space in one long, sweeping, and horrified glance.
"Jesus Christ," Samson said. "This isn't right."
Chapter 73.
The pig was 40 pounds or so. It was in a low wire pen and was missing a 2-inch wide strip of skin along the length of its spine. It was clearly in terrible pain. A lamb was in a pen beside the pig. 3 of its legs were broken, and it was struggling piteously. The dog, a beagle, had been beaten with a blunt object. It tried over and over to get to its feet, but it kept falling and yelping for help. 3 GoPro cameras on tripods were aimed at the cages. Beyond the pens, a long workbench stretched the length of the sidewall. On it were dozens of pieces of grotesque taxidermy, animals stuffed in their tortured state. Behind the bench, the rear sliding door of the pole barn was open to the big garden. 30, maybe 40 more creatures, small dogs and cats, wild things like skunks and possums, even an owl, were stuffed in positions that preserved their agony and set in the garden in neat little rows. A few were dressed in doll clothes, which only made the situation more disturbing.
"We need to call in the locals," Samson said.
Before I could reply, a man wearing headphones appeared in the open doorway to the garden. Bone thin and dressed in painter's pants and a green wife beater, he had skin as pale as a fish belly, pinkish eyes, and wispy hair the color of snow. 2 steps into the barn, as he was smiling at the wounded animals in their pens, he spotted us over by the door. He ripped off his headphones.
"Who the hell are you?" he demanded.
"Police," Samson said, holding up his badge.
"You Carter Flint?"
Shock locked Flint in his tracks for a second as he looked from John's badge to the suffering animals. Then he whirled and flew out the barn door. I tore after him. I had no jurisdiction. I wasn't even a cop, technically. But after what I'd seen, I wasn't letting the sadist who'd done it get away. Neither was Samson. He was off my left shoulder, exiting the barn into the garden. Flint was surprisingly fast and nimble. He was already beyond the garden's borders and racing behind 2 other outbuildings toward the north tree line at the base of a ridge 150 yards away.
"If he makes those woods, we'll lose him," Samson growled.
I gritted my teeth and danced through the stuffed animals until I hit the grass. Then I told myself to be like Janny, relax and run. For 30 yards, I was convinced I'd catch him. But Flint was younger and, judging from the way he was gaining ground, much fitter than me. But not fitter than Samson, who blew by me. When Flint was 40 yards from the woods, he hit tall, tangled grass. It slowed him, but it didn't slow John, whose long legs had him leaping after the sadist. Flint looked back in desperation and then lunged for the woods. Samson ran up a hummock in the weeds and dived after him. Chapter 74. Samson's shoulder and his 220 pounds drove into the back of Flint's legs, flattening him in the deep, wet grass. I ran up, gasping, as John straddled the sadist and kept his shoulders pinned.
"My knee," Flint moaned. "Something snapped, and I got broken ribs."
Samson dug out zip cuffs and wrenched Flint's arm up behind him, which provoked another round of howling.
"My ribs!"
"Screw your ribs," Samson said. "And screw your knee. You're lucky I don't kick out your front teeth."
I helped Samson up and then pulled Flint to his feet. His left leg buckled and he began to whimper.
"I can't help it, man. I got a mental sickness. I tried to stop. I did, but..."
"Save it for a judge," Samson said.
"Where are the blonde women?" I said. "Which building?"
He didn't react at first. Then he looked confused.
"What blonde women?"
"The ones you made those movies of," Samson said. "Fake executions. Uploaded them to the Killing Blonde Chick site."
"No," he said. "I watched some free videos on that site, but that's not me."
"All the recent uploads have been coming from your IP," Samson said.
Flint shook his head.
"I've never submitted to that site. Never. I do animals for animal sites, not humans. I'd never do humans."
"Try telling that to a jury after they've seen your barn," I said.
"I'm telling the truth," he said. "Maybe I deserve punishment for what I've done, who I am. But if those blonde videos came through my IP, man, someone frickin' hacked and hijacked my computer. I'm being framed."
Part 4. In Defense of Alex Cross. Chapter 75. Shortly before dark, Samson dropped me off at the entrance to the alley that runs behind my house.
With my trial starting up again in the morning, there were bound to be more journalists in front of my house.
There'd been other journalists gathering at the bottom of Carter Flint's road when we left. After Samson called the local sheriff to tell them we'd made a citizen's arrest, we'd waited until Flint was in custody and the three animals mercifully euthanized before we helped in the search for the girls. We'd found enough disturbing evidence to put Flint behind bars or in a psychiatric institution for years, but no trace of Gretchen Lindell or Delilah Franks or the four other missing women. I used the back gate to our yard, happy for the darkness, and went in the side door. My dad and Janie were watching a tape of her race at Hopkins. Bree was in the kitchen with Nana Mama.
"How was fishing?" my dad said.
Before I could answer, Bree called archly.
"Yes, how was fishing?"
I gave my dad a chagrined look and walked to the kitchen.
"You know,"
she crossed her arms,
"I know everything. What were you thinking, going up there and just barging in like that?"
"That was John's call on his own time. I just tagged along." She really wasn't happy.
"You said you'd be straight with me."
I lowered my voice, said,
"Straight with you?"
"Okay, it was bad. The worst animal cruelty I've ever seen. I feel like I've been dipped in a jar of creepiness, but we stopped more animals from being tortured by that piece of shit."
Bree struggled, her eyes searching mine, and then threw up her hands. "Go take a shower."
Turning from the stove, Nana Mama said,
"Dinner in half an hour."
"Smells good. What is it?"
"It's a secret."
"I'll be right back down," I said. I leaned over Bree's cold shoulder and kissed her on the cheek.
"There's something on the table in the hall for you, Alex,"
my grandmother called after me as I left the room. In the front hall, I spotted a small U.S. Postal Service mailer addressed to Dr. Cross, no return address. I opened it to find the same kind of flash drive that the fake Alden Lindell had shown me. It was inside a plastic sleeve.
"You might want to see this," I said, waving the envelope at Bree.
We went down to my basement office. Bree put on latex gloves and plugged the drive in. A few moments later, a QuickTime app launched and showed a low-light video of a handcuffed, barefoot woman in a tattered white nightgown. She had a white hood over her head and was being led to a mossy stone wall by two guys dressed in black from shoes to hoods. When they reached the wall, one of the men spun her around. The other yanked off the hood, revealing a gagged blonde teen. I felt sick, said, "Gretchen Lindell."
They took off the gag. The camera pulled back to show three men about 50 feet from Gretchen. They were all hooded, all dressed in black, and all carrying AR rifles.
"Ready?" the cameraman said. The three men shouldered their rifles. I expected Gretchen to go to her knees and beg for mercy, but instead, she stood tall against the stone wall and stuck her chin out at the firing squad.
"Go ahead," she yelled at them. "I'm not afraid. You can do anything you want, and I'm not afraid of any of you."
"Aim,"
the cameraman said.
"You won't do it," Gretchen screamed. "You kill me, you don't get to play your games anymore. You kill me, fire!"
The guns went off. In the low light, orange flames shot out of their muzzles. By the sparks the ricochets threw, the bullets hit stone inches around her head. It broke Gretchen, who went to her knees, shaking in terror.
"Don't!" she wept. "Don't!"
Then the screen froze, and I heard the voice of the fake Alden Lindell say, "Next time, it's for real, Dr. Cross. Next time, every blonde bitch, including little Gretchen, dies. And forget about finding me before then. I exist in the digital void, invisible, 10 steps ahead of you and the FBI.
The video ended with that same brilliant flash I'd seen the first time I'd plugged in one of his thumb drives.
"He's definitely part of the killing blonde chick's conspiracy," I said, thinking about Flint's insistence that someone had hijacked his computer. Then I thought about the fact that the fake Alden Lindell had mailed the flash drive to me rather than bringing it in person.
He knew I'd figured him out, I said.
How? That flash at the end of the videos kept playing in my mind until I formed a very strong suspicion.
I think there's a good chance he's bugged my computer somehow, I told Bree.
And maybe the FBI's. That would keep him 10 steps ahead of us, wouldn't it?
Chapter 76.
When I finally got in the shower, I was no longer merely suspicious, but convinced my computer had been compromised by the fake Alden Lindell. I'd called Rawlins and Batra at the FBI to alert them, but neither of them picked up the phone. I left them messages saying that I believed their system was at risk as well, and I hoped they'd call sooner rather than later. Under the hot water, I felt sickened again at what Flint had done to those animals, and at the fact that he claimed there were tens of thousands of subscribers to the websites he sold his footage to. Was that true? What possible pleasure could someone find in innocent animals suffering? It was so beyond me that I got angry. That anger only deepened when I considered my inability to make headway in the hunt for the missing blondes, especially Gretchen Lindell. What a brave thing she'd done, standing up to those men like that, defying them. When at last I turned my thoughts to the trial, I got angrier still, and then depressed. 2 eyewitnesses had testified that I'd shot 3 people without just cause. There were videos of the shootings, and no sign of computer-generated imaging or anything to suggest I was being framed. The weight of those cold, hard facts kept growing as I showered myself into a darker mood. A conspiracy had been hatched and directed at me. The conspiracy was working. The gears of justice were grinding, and I could see no path out. I got dressed and went downstairs in a black cloud.
"Doesn't It's a Secret smell incredible?" Bree said when I came back into the kitchen.
Distracted, I nodded. Out in the great room, my dad chuckled.
"I think I love It's a Secret."
"You will,"
Nana Mama said.
"Where's that Ali?"
"Where he's been the past 4 days," Janie said with a roll of her eyes. "Up in Dad's old office in the attic with the door shut." "He's still working on his Houdini paper?" I said. "I'll go get him."
"Let me," my dad said, coming into the kitchen. "Give me some time to bond with my grandkiddo."
Drummond disappeared. I helped Bree set the table, wondering how many more times we'd get to do this simple chore together. I opened a bottle of white wine and poured myself a generous glass. Bree was watching me.
"One healthy one," I said.
"You deserve 2 healthy ones.
"Dinner's on,"
Nana Mama said, bringing a big iron skillet with a lid to the table. She set it on a lazy Susan.
"Rice is coming. Where's that Ali now?"
Before I could reply, she left the kitchen and went to the bottom of the stairs.
"Dinner, Ali! You don't want dinner cold. You better come on down."
2 minutes, my dad called. "He's showing me something."
My grandmother came back muttering under her breath. She'd always been a stickler for us being at the table when she was ready to serve, and she had a sour expression on her face when she brought a big bowl of steaming jasmine rice in and sat down.
"Let's say grace," she said. "We don't have to wait."
When we were done thanking God for the meal, Nana Mama lifted the lid on the skillet. The smells that wafted up made me close my eyes and smile. My grandmother said,
"Tiger shrimp in fresh tomatoes, onions, garlic, and It's a Secret."
"Mmm, Nana,"
Janie said after taking her first bite.
"What is that?"
"That's the secret," she said, smiling.
"Good, isn't it, Alex?"
"Amazing," I said, but my mind was elsewhere.
"You don't sound very amazed," Nana Mama said.
I set my fork down. "It's delicious, Nana, really, but I think we all need to talk about what life will look like if I'm sent to prison." Nana Mama's face fell. Bree grew distant. Janie's eyes welled with tears, and she said,
"I don't want to think about that, Dad.
Ali came running into the kitchen.
"Dad, you won't believe it!"
My grandmother said,
"Now is not a good time, Ali."
My son stopped short.
"But not now, Ali,"
Janie shouted, and she broke down in tears.
My father came in behind Ali and said to me,
"You better listen to him, son."
Chapter 77.
Looking weak but determined, Judge Larch wrapped her gavel and called the court to order at 9 the next morning. Bree and my dad sat behind me. I'd been up until 3 a.m., had slept fitfully, and was feeling fuzzy and on edge from 2 cups of high-test Brazilian coffee. Larch stared down through her thick lenses and said in a restrained voice,
"Ms. Marley, have your analysts examined the videos?"
Looking chagrined, Anita said, "They agreed that they have not been tampered with digitally. The defense has no further objection to the videos." The judge seemed disappointed. Assistant U.S. Attorney Nathan Wills was stone-faced, but nodding his head and jiggling his knee, probably already working on his closing arguments in his mind.
"Mr. Wills," Larch said.
"A moment, Your Honor," the prosecutor said. Then he leaned over to his assistant, Athena Carlyle, and whispered something in her ear. Carlyle drew back with a startled expression and shook her head emphatically. Their conversation got heated, and then Wills stood up. He glanced at his scowling assistant and threw back his shoulders, which thrust his belly forward against his starched white shirt.
"The people rest, Your Honor."
That surprised me, and it didn't. According to the witness list Wills and Carlyle had provided, there were 6 or 7 more people slated to appear, mostly to testify about ballistics and other basic crime scene evidence. But why bother when the videos were legitimate?
"Ms. Marley," the judge said, "you're up."
Anita had evidently been half expecting the prosecution to rest as well, because without hesitation she said,
"Defense calls Kimiko Binks for Cross."
Binks came forward wearing black slacks, black pumps, a black blouse with a high collar, and costume pearls. I got the distinct feeling she was more concerned about her appearance than about facing the formidable Anita Marley.
"You're still under oath, Miss Binks," Judge Larch said.
The web designer nodded and sat down with composure and poise. Anita said, "Miss Binks, did you alert Claude Watkins that you were on your way the day of the shootings? Call to tell him you were coming to the factory with my client?"
"No," she said, "I don't think so."
Naomi handed Anita a plastic evidence bag. Anita took it over to Binks. "Recognize this?" Anita said. Binks frowned and took the bag, saw what it was.
"It's a spot."
Anita looked to the jury.
"A SPOT is a satellite personnel tracker, a GPS device that tracks the wearer. Runners like Ms. Binks use them to plot their workout routes. Isn't that correct?"
Binks nodded.
"And in cases of emergency, you can send an SOS signal. There's also a button that allows you to send a prepared text to people you list on the SPOT website, correct?"
I guess.
"Actually, we looked at your account with SPOT, Ms. Binks," Anita said. "On the day of the shootings, from your apartment and 20 minutes before you arrived at the factory, you pressed that button and sent a text to Claude Watkins that read, 'Game on.'"
"I don't remember that," Binks said, pushing back her hair.
"And what does it matter?"
Anita smiled and said, "It shows premeditation, Ms. Binks." Chapter 78. Binks's face fell, but she said,
"Premeditation of what? Performance art?"
Anita did not answer. Instead, she said,
"As I understand it, you were taken into custody after the shootings, is that correct?"
"They let me go after they figured out the truth."
"But you were booked, yes? Fingerprints, cheek swabs, photographed for your mugshot?"
"It was humiliating," the witness said coldly. "I'd done nothing wrong."
Anita returned to the defense table. Naomi handed her several thin files and a large sealed plastic bag. Anita handed one of the files to Wills and then went to the bench. "The defense would like to introduce exhibits A, B, C, and D," she said, handing Judge Larch a file. "Exhibit A includes chain of evidence documentation for cheek swabs taken from Ms. Binks by D.C. Metro Police shortly after the shootings.
Exhibit B documents the FBI's chain of evidence following cheek swabs taken 2 days later from my client upon his arrest. Exhibits C and D include the results of tests of those swab samples that the defense requested from the FBI lab.
Genetic analysis, Judge Larch said.
Your Honor, Will said, rising, this is the first we've heard of any swabs or lab analysis.
Not true, Anita said. My assistant found reference to the swabs in the materials you sent us during discovery, Mr. Wills.
And no, Your Honor, we did not do genetic analysis. We had tests done on the saliva, not the cheek cells used for DNA testing.
I'll admit the files, Larch said.
Your Honor, Wills said.
The judge fixed the prosecutor with a withering stare, and I realized it was well past her usual time to recess for a puff or two. Wills was swimming in very dangerous waters.
The reports are in, Mr. Wills, Larch said. Ms. Marley?
Anita brought a copy over to Binks, handed it to the witness.
Can you look at page 4 of Dr. Cross's saliva test results, third line of the summary?
Carlisle and Wills were frantically turning the pages of the report. Judge Larch was already studying her copy. Binks glanced up sharply at Anita.
Can you read it out loud, please? My attorney said.
Binks twisted uncomfortably, looking as if a lasso had been looped over her head and cinched snug beneath her ribcage. In a dull monotone, she read,
Saliva test detected the presence of methylene dioxymethamphetamine,
MDMA, a hallucinatory drug also known as Molly or ecstasy.
Chapter 79.
Ecstasy? Molly? I flashed back to that weird, giddy state I was in when I entered the factory, and how I'd screamed in an uncontrollable rage that I was going to kill every Sinigi in sight. No wonder my emotions had been on a roller coaster ride that entire day. No wonder I'd felt like hell for days afterward. Anita pivoted from Binks to the jury and said, MDMA. A euphoric, mind-altering drug. A drug that doctors say leaves the body at a fairly predictable rate based on dosage. Miss Binks, what does line 4 of the summary say?
Binks was clearly uncomfortable now, but read.
Further tests indicate dosage of 140 milligrams or more of MDMA introduced to subject 42 to 48 hours prior to the gathering of samples.
Anita said, 140 milligrams of ecstasy taken 42 to 48 hours before the saliva samples were taken.
That is a 6-hour time span that, if I'm not mistaken, includes the 2 hours prior to the shootings when you were with Dr. Cross, Ms. Binks.
I expected Wills to object. His assistant, Athena Carlisle, obviously expected the same thing because she glanced at her boss. When she saw he wasn't moving, she stood up.
Carlisle said, Your Honor, is Ms. Marley honestly laying the foundation for an insanity plea, saying Dr. Cross was out of his mind at the time of the shooting because of ecstasy?
We are not, Your Honor, Anita said hotly. Dr. Cross is one of the sanest people I've ever known. I'm just setting the context for what Dr. Cross did or did not see that day.
Objection, Will said, standing beside his assistant. Who's testifying here, Ms. Marley or Ms. Binks?
Ms. Binks, Anita said, and she returned to the witness box.
Can you look to page 5 of the report, the results of tests done on saliva samples taken from you several hours after the shootings, lines 3 and 4?
Binks lowered her head and then shook it.
That's not true.
The FBI says it is indeed true, Anita said, and she looked to her own copy of the files.
Line 4, quote, further tests indicate a dosage of 119 milligrams introduced to bloodstream 4 to 6 hours prior to the gathering of sample.
Binks said nothing.
Did you ingest ecstasy earlier on the day of the shootings? Anita asked.
Binks looked around warily.
That would be illegal, wouldn't it?
Answer the question. Binks hesitated for several moments before straightening up in her chair and saying,
I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me.
That set off a hubbub in the courtroom. Larch gaveled for quiet. Amused, Anita said, "You're invoking the Fifth Amendment for taking ecstasy?"
"I didn't say that," Binks said. "You kind of did."
"Objection," Carlyle cried. "Sustained," Larch said. "The jury will ignore that." Anita showed no reaction. "Miss Binks, the morning of the shootings, after you came back from your run, do you remember tripping in your apartment and Dr. Cross catching you before you could fall?" She hesitated, frowned. "No." "Yes, you tripped over an electrical cord. When Dr. Cross caught you, you put a piece of clear adhesive tape on the underside of his forearm, didn't you?"
"Objection," Will said warily.
"Where's the foundation for this?" Anita said.
"Your Honor, Dr. Cross and his wife, D.C. Chief of Detectives Bree Stone, will testify that they found a piece of tape on the underside of Dr. Cross's right forearm in the hours after the shootings. We believe that the ecstasy was on that tape in a gel or powdered form, and that it was absorbed into Dr. Cross's bloodstream transdermally through the skin."
"Where is this tainted tape?" the prosecutor said. "Render the body, Counselor." Anita ignored him, said to the judge, "Neither Dr. Cross nor Chief Stone thought much of it at the time, and they threw the tape out at GW Medical Center." Wills shook his head even more wearily. "Move to strike everything Ms. Marley has said about this phantom piece of tape, Your Honor."
"So moved," Larch said.
"Your Honor," Anita started.
"No tape, no talk about tape," the judge said sharply.
Anita sighed, said, "Miss Binks, did you dose Dr. Cross with ecstasy?" Binks blinked, chewed on her lip, glanced at Wills, and then said again, "I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me."
Chapter 80. When Judge Larch called for lunch recess and left the courtroom slowly, the prosecutors weren't looking quite as confident as they had earlier. Anita had asked Binks several more questions about the ecstasy, including how it was that she had been given the perfect dose of MDMA for her weight, and how it was that I was given the perfect dose for mine. Binks had replied to every question about the drug by taking the Fifth. "Tripping on ecstasy doesn't get your client off," Will said to Anita as she packed away some files.
"No," she said. "Fortunately, a jury gets to make that decision."
"No tainted tape, no causality. Even you can see that."
Anita gave him a blank expression. "Save it for your clothes." Athena Carlyle said, "Given the videos, are you open to talking plea bargain? Dr. Cross might get out in time to meet his great-grandkids." Anita glanced at me. I shook my head. Carlyle puffed her cheeks, then blew out air.
"We tried."
"Suit yourself," Wills said, and he chuckled as he left. "But I hear it's hell for an ex-cop in prison."
Naomi, Bree, my dad, and I ate takeout pulled pork sandwiches in a conference room. Even though Anita had scored big points with her cross-examination, we were a somber, focused bunch. For the first time in a week, I felt jurors 5 and 11 leaning a bit my way, or at least developing some skepticism regarding the prosecution's case. But Wills had been right. The ecstasy might be a mitigating factor, but it wouldn't be enough to acquit me of 2 murders and an attempted murder. We were back in court with 2 minutes to spare. Anita was already there. "We good?" I asked. She leaned over to me, murmured, "Pray for a knockout." "And David slew Goliath," I said before the bailiff called. "All rise." Judge Larch looked considerably less agitated when she retook the bench and called the court to order.
"Ms. Marley," Larch said, "do you wish to cross-examine Mr. Watkins now, or does the defense have its own witnesses in mind?"
"Defense witness, Your Honor," Anita said. "We call Ali Cross to the stand." I twisted in my seat in time to see Ali enter the courtroom, holding my dad's hand with Janny and Nana Mama behind them. My boy was in his Sunday best, gray pants, an ironed white shirt, and a paisley bow tie. Juror 11 smiled seeing him. At the bar, Nana Mama whispered something in her great-grandson's ear, and he nodded. Ali did not look at me or Anita before pushing open the gate and walking confidently to the witness stand.
Will said, "Your Honor,
The defense gave us no notice of this witness.
Ali is Dr. Cross's son, Your Honor, Anita said. Judge Larch looked skeptical.
And he has business before this court?
Yes, Your Honor, he has a few things to say. The judge peered over at Ali, who was standing in the witness box now.
How old are you, Ali?
9, but I'm in 5th grade already.
Where do you go to school?
Washington Latin?
Larch smiled. Good for you. Swear him in.
Afterward, the bailiff had to get pads for the witness chair so Ali could sit higher and be seen easier by the jury. Once he'd settled in, Anita said,
Ali, do you normally do what your father tells you to do? By that I mean, when he gives you a direct order, do you obey it?
Yes, ma'am, I try.
But you defied one of his direct orders recently, didn't you?
Yes, ma'am, I did.
Objection, Will said.
Your Honor, where is the relevance of this?
Anita looked at him, said, The court is about to find out.
Get to it, Ms. Marley, Larch said.
What did you do that your father didn't want you to do? Anita said.
Ali said,
My dad told me not to look at the videos of the shootings in that factory, but I secretly looked at them on YouTube.
Once?
No, like 170 times.
That provoked some nervous laughter, and I could tell Juror 5, the retired engineer with the hunched back, did not like the idea of a 9-year-old boy looking at those videos even once, let alone 170 times.
Why did you watch it so many times? Anita said.
To figure out where the guns went so Dad wouldn't go to prison.
Anita glanced over at Wills and then at the jury.
Did you figure out where the guns went?
I think so.
Objection! Athena Carlyle said. Your Honor, we've been through this. Real experts have looked at the videos and found nothing wrong with them. We're expected to believe a 9-year-old discovered something that they didn't?
Ms. Marley, Judge Larch said.
Let the boy speak, Your Honor, Anita said in a reasonable tone. Echoing what you said when you allowed the videos to be introduced, the prosecution is free to rebut if Ali is wrong. The judge adjusted her glasses and then looked over at Ali.
Did you really figure it out?
I think so, he said.
Let's hear it.
Naomi put the videos up on the screen and gave Ali a remote control, stopping the 3 videos in strategic places in much the same way the prosecution had made its case against me. Ali was able to show the jury how the lighting changed in the videos, how it grew slightly dimmer before each victim appeared, and then brightened considerably just before I shot.
What do you think is happening there with the lighting? Anita said.
Ali said,
Whoever was controlling the spotlights dimmed them just before Mrs. Winslow, Mr. Watkins, and Mr. Diggs stepped into view. It's hard to see them in that weaker light, but they're there. And then the spotlights are boosted, and you see the empty hands just as my father shoots.
Okay, Anita said. So what?
That's what I kept thinking, Ali said.
So what?
Until I read the autopsy reports.
Chapter 81. Judge Larch whirled her chair around and glared at me through those Coke bottle lenses.
You let a 9-year-old read autopsy reports, Dr. Cross?
I wasn't supposed to, Judge, Ali said, twisting in his chair to address her.
But I did it anyway.
Larch looked away from me, squinted at my boy, and said,
You on the road to criminality, son?
Ali smiled nervously.
No, ma'am, Your Honor.
No, I know you're not, Larch said, softer and her expression eased toward amused resignation.
Go ahead.
Ali testified that he defied Bree and me and dug out the autopsy reports on Virginia Winslow and Leonard Diggs, looking for something odd about the gun hands of the 3 victims.
Did you find something odd? Anita asked.
Yes,
Ali said.
Gunpowder residue?
He shook his head.
They had sticky stuff on their palms.
Adhesive glue?
Yes, like from tape. And there was also, like, some silicone.
Is there an explanation for the glue or silicone in the report?
No.
Can you explain why it was there?
My son sat up straighter.
I think I can explain why, but not exactly how. That's like physics.
and I haven't studied that yet. Maybe next year.
The jury members started laughing. Anita smiled, letting the moment last, then said,
Why was the glue and silicone there? Well, if you think about it, because of this, he said, running the videos back and stopping them. See the three spotlights in the middle feed? And to the right at the bottom of the right spotlight, there's a pinpoint blue light? That's where I almost had it figured out. But like I said, the rest is physics that I don't get.
Anita smiled. Thank you, Ali. Your Honor, if it please the court, I'd like to call a second witness who can explain more clearly than Ali can what the pinpoint blue light, the glue, the silicone, and the dimming and brightening mean. Mr. Wills can cross-examine them both afterwards.
Any objection, Mr. Wills?
Wills and Carlyle conferred. Wills looked irritated when he turned from his assistant and said,
Be my guest, Counselor. Take us on a wild goose chase.
The defense calls Keith Carl Rawlins, Anita said. Crazy Cat came in wearing a fine blue Italian suit, black loafers buffed to a high shine, and a coral pink shirt open at the collar. His mohawk was down, dyed black, slicked over to the left side of his head, and tucked behind his ear. As he walked past Ali, who was leaving the stand, Rawlins nodded and winked at him. Wills and Carlyle acted like someone had brought a jester into court, but they didn't know what to do about it yet. After he was sworn in, Anita said,
Dr. Rawlins, can you describe your academic training and current position?
Rawlins said,
I have dual PhDs from Stanford, one in physics, the other in electrical engineering. I'm working on my doctorate in computer science at MIT, and I'm currently employed as an independent contractor by the cyber division of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Wills and Carlyle jumped to their feet.
Objection, Wills said. No one at the Bureau informed the prosecution this witness was testifying.
Carlyle said,
Your Honor, agents are required to notify the U.S. Attorney's Office that I'm not a special agent, and I'm not even an employee, Rawlins said. As such, I'm not obligated to notify the FBI or the U.S. Attorney's Office. I came at the request of a very bright young man who sought me out at my home during my free time and presented his rather brilliant theory of the videos. I do not speak for the government, only for myself, as a citizen compelled to tell the truth.
Your Honor, we still object to
Asked and answered, Mr. Wills, Judge Larch said.
Both prosecutors looked like they'd swallowed worms, but they sat. Anita said,
What kind of work do you do for the FBI, Dr. Rawlins?
It's classified, so I can't give you specifics, but you could say I helped the Bureau on the techno side of things.
Physics involved?
Sometimes.
Is physics involved here, with the video, I mean?
Yes, he said. Basic physics, wave theory.
Chapter 82. Anita glanced at the jury. A few, including Juror 5, were attentive. The eyes of the rest, including Jurors 11, the PR executive, appeared glazed over by this turn in the trial.
Physics? Wave theory?
But Anita had foreseen this response. She looked to Naomi and nodded. As my niece got up and left the courtroom, my attorney said,
Dr. Rawlins, let's keep it very basic, shall we?
Rawlins shrugged and looked to the jury.
All you really need to know is that light travels in waves, just like in the ocean. When the waves from different light sources collide, they're both changed, just like waves on the ocean coming from different directions and crashing into one another.
Naomi came back into the courtroom, pushing a cart loaded with several cardboard boxes and a small spotlight.
Keep that in mind, Rawlins said, getting up from the witness stand. Waves colliding on the ocean. With the court's permission?
Granted, Larch said. I always liked show and tell.
I was a big fan too, Rawlins said.
He went to Naomi, took the spotlight, and set it up on a tripod.
Judge, can I use an assistant? Rawlins said.
Larch waved her hand, and the FBI contractor called Ali from the audience. Rawlins got a manila envelope from the cart, drew out something he kept hidden, and put it in Ali's palm. When my son opened his hand, you had to look closely to see what seemed to be one of those protective films people put on cell phone screens. Thin, translucent, and rectangular, it was affixed to Ali's palm and went up to the first joints of his fingers.
What is that?